for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 633 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week we have another great doubleheader episode. So I'm talking with Chad Harden from The Art of Chad Harden, Volume 4 on Zoop.gg, then Shane Berryhill from Deathslingers with Cosmic Lion Productions. Everything starts with Chad Harden, who has a Zoop.gg project underway for the fourth volume of his The Art of Chad Harden series. Here's how this latest book is described. Marvel and DC's celebrated artist Chad Harden is making his Zoop debut with The Art of Chad Harden Volume 4. The first three volumes were huge crowdfunding successes, and Volume 4 unveils new published and unpublished gems and dives into his creator-owned projects and behind-the-scenes magic, showcasing private commissions and unveiling the meticulous process from concept to completion. It's a must-have for comic art aficionados. We discuss Chad's career to date, what is expected to be included in this fourth volume, and what else is coming from Chad soon. Be sure you back this project before it concludes on Friday, March 29. Then everything wraps up with Shane Berryhill's first interview here on the podcast. We delve into his most recent comics, including Comic Books Kill, Jason and the Olympians, and Deathslinger. Here's how Deathslinger is described. The Holy Reich has fallen, leaving the galaxy in chaos. It was a perfect storm for those who trafficked in blood and war. It was the age of the Deathslinger. We look into who the characters are in this book, briefly explore his other projects, and find out what else is coming from him in the months ahead. You can go to the Cosmic Lion Productions website to order this great book and find out about other offerings coming from this landmark comic company. This book is now available, so be sure to order yours once you've finished listening to this great interview. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they both have to say. There is a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast artist Chad Harden, who is probably known for Harley Quinn art and other things. I pulled up a DC page with all your stuff, and wow, there's a lot of stuff you've done for DC. I saw in Marvel you've done two covers is all I could see.
That's growing. I met back up with Ricky Purden, who's the talent coordinator at Marvel, and since San Diego, I've been probably averaging 2 to 3 covers a month with them. So I'm really happy for that. Hopefully as the websites get updated, that'll get more populated. But yeah, be on the lookout for some more Marvel covers headed your way.
The ones that I see are Edge of Spider-Verse number 2 and number 3.
Well, I got number one. I did all the trade dress covers for that. So 1 through 4.
Okay.
And then a lot of this stuff is variants or incentive variants. So like Incredible Hulk number 8 was a 1 in 25 incentive. What If Venom number 1, I think that was. So on some of these, they have 3 different trades. It's like A, B, and C. I was trade C. You know, it's so crazy. Like, it used to just be that there was one cover, right? And now there's, like, so many, it's hard to keep track of. But, yeah. But Ghost Rider number 1. Rise of the Power website. Of X number 4. Yeah. I've done quite a few, so.
Okay. Because when I go to the DC page, that's a lot busier. Harley Quinn, I'm trying to see which ones you didn't do.
right. Yeah.
1, 2, 3, They're not in order. That's the bad news. It starts with number 12, and then it goes to number 9, then it goes to 29 from 2013. Oh, heavens. All kinds of good stuff. Zatanna, you've done. Our Fighting Forces. Dr. Fate. The Spirit. Yeah. It looks like the only one you really haven't done are the Trinity, the big three, which is hard to get to. I imagine to do this work. But artwork, and I've looked at it. It's very strong, very good. And I'm just sort of curious. This on Zoop, this is your fourth Art of Chad Harden book. So I haven't seen the other ones before. But, Chris, I have to admit, I'm not an art book guy. I like the stories with it. But I always – and this is something I always ask people when they do an artwork. That you have to – tell a story in a picture,
right? You're doing a narrative. Well, a lot of the comic covers used to be very narrative. Like you could look at the cover and know what's going to be on the inside of the book. Mm-hmm. A lot of the covers now are just sort of pinups, and so mm-hmm. like the narrative covers are sort of becoming like a lost art form. And that's anytime I get a chance to do a cover, I'm trying to do a narrative illustration. I'm trying to tell a story. I'm not just doing a pinup. Now, don't get me wrong. I've done pinups. I'm going to be asked to do pinups in the future, but if I have my way, it's going to be a narrative cover. So,
okay. Well, that makes sense. It's a little more than just a pinup, and I like pinups too, but I do like the ones that tell kind of a story, even in one picture. There was one guy I was interviewing, and he had this character looking off camera. And when I got to talk with him, I asked, "Who's that person looking at?" You know, they're looking off page and off panel. And I'm going like, "What's going on?" He said, "Well, that's for your imagination to supply." He says to me,
"Exactly."
Got me.
It was very good. It's the whole Alfred Hitchcock. It's better to not show everything. Mm-hmm. Let the viewer fill in with their imagination.
Mm-hmm. Now I don't know which one to start with. You've got the previous three volumes out. How long have they been out? Did they come out like on a regular basis or semi-regular? How often do they come out?
They did come out on a regular basis, and then COVID hit, and there was basically like a 3-year gap. But the plan is to do one a year, if not. And that was one of the things I excited to talk with Eric and Jordan about. We actually have enough that we could make two volumes right now if we wanted to. So we're going to see how this campaign goes, and then we're ready to roll on the next one. So hopefully we'll do Art of Chad Harden volume number 4, Death Watch number 2, and then Art of Chad Harden volume 5, all with Zoop coming up here pretty quick.
Oh, great. Okay. Let's talk about this, because when this posts, your campaign is well underway. And my understanding is that this is going to conclude in late March. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. The campaign should run somewhere around the end of February to the end of March for 30 days. Yep.
Okay. And you were telling me there's 60 pages in the book.
Yeah. And I'm going to have it split up. So if you haven't seen the covers that I've been doing for Marvel, they're going to be in there. So about 25% for Marvel, 25% for DC, 25% for like independent covers and art. And then I'm doing a lot of creator-owned work. I don't know if you got a chance to check out The Hunters I did with Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor. Mm-hmm. That Kickstarter just ended. You're going to get to see a lot of behind-the-scenes art there and some process art, as well as my own book, Death Watch, which that campaign also just ended in December. So,
wow.
Yeah. Okay.
So you're a busy guy.
I am a busy guy. Yes. And then you got conventions on top of that. You got, whatnot sales. Everything's just speeds up. It doesn't slow down. So,
oh, wow. So you do whatnot as well.
I do. I've done a few of my own shows, but I'm really fortunate to get an open-end invitation with SMK. Or I'm sorry, SMZ, and we did a whole bunch of whatnot with them at MegaCon, and it was a big hit with their viewers. So I'll be back.
Shoot, I didn't bump into you at MegaCon. I was there. I was only there one day. I used to go for multiple days, but those were in the days when I collected action figures and I was looking for stuff. Now I'm mostly just talking to creators and trying to get people to be on my podcast and stuff like that, or trying to put a face with the voice. It's oftentimes when I'm doing the con. So I was at MegaCon, but I was only there Friday, and I did not see you. So I was at that. Are you going to, any chance you might come back next year?
Yeah, the only year I missed MegaCon, I missed it the previous year in 2023 because my son got married. I had the table, I had the invitations, I'd sent out the stuff on social media. And he's in the military. He got home from deployment and it was like, hey, I'm getting married. We're like, you know.
Not that, that weekend.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So basically there's a few shows that I plan on attending every year: San Diego, New York, MegaCon, Dallas. And then either C2E. I'm not gonna be at C2E2 this year. I got an invite to Alaska. Wow. And I chose to go there because there's only 5 states that I haven't been to: Alaska, Wyoming, Montana, and North and South Dakota. So after this trip, I'll just have the 4, and hopefully I can knock those out in a giant road trip or something. Yeah.
Have you ever been to Dragon Con?
I haven't. I get asked by fans all the time. So I've never been to Dragon Con. I've never been to Heroes Con, and it's simply because usually for me to go to a show, I let the promoters reach out to me. Mm-hmm. I usually don't reach out to them. And for whatever reason, and I tell anytime my fans ask, I'm like, the best way to get me to a show is ask the promoters to have me out. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully one day, but
I'll tell you a little bit so far. I don't know how much you know about Dragon Con, but Dragon Con is like in downtown Atlanta. In Georgia. And what they have is they have like 4 or 5 buildings that they take over. And I was there helping somebody sell product at in the comic section. There was like 6 levels in this building we were in. The comics level was the 4th level. Mm-hmm. There were 3 levels beneath us that were comic related merchandise, you know, leather and swords and all that kind of good stuff. And above us were 2 levels with other stuff. But that one floor could have been a convention for other places. Oh. And the thing that's really interesting to me was that it's like a party all weekend long. There's 3 in the morning. There's rock bands playing, comic-related music and stuff like that. And all kinds of amazing things going on. It was a lot of fun. I do have to say I enjoyed it tremendously. So it was... I always encourage people to go there. Now, you're already going to my favorite con. My favorite con is New York. I love New York. It is literally, if you want glasses with comic book faces on them, you can buy them in New York. If you want, I don't know, anything basically that's comic related or something, you can go to New York. Although I understand they're doing a lot more anime stuff recently, so we'll see.
You know, I think a lot of the big conventions are sort of turning into, you know, pop culture events. Mm-hmm. It's pretty hard to find some hardcore, straight up Comic Cons anymore. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, that's one of the great things about Heroes Con. Everyone tells me like Heroes Con is a straight up comic convention. Mm-hmm. Baltimore is a lot more comic focused.
Yep.
Have you ever been to WonderCon? I really enjoyed WonderCon.
I have not. It's one of the ones I've been to. I've been to San Diego several times. I have never gotten to WonderCon. That's one of the ones on my list of places I want to go. Cause people talk about it very affectionately and I really want to go. So it
feels like Comic-Con before the movie craziness sort of took over. Yeah.
See, there was a con in Miami, and the name escapes me right at the moment. But they had 2/3 of the con were pop stars and other things like that. And there was only like 1/3 that had comics. And I went to the organizer and I said, well, why'd you do that? And they said, well, that's because we get more people from the uncomic areas than we do from the comic areas. And I said, oh, sorry to hear that. But,
they still do that kind of stuff. And because even if you notice at MegaCon, there are just mobs of people to get autographs and stuff like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's funny. Like, I remember there was sort of a brouhaha this last 2023 at San Diego because Comic-Con was happening during the actor strike.
Yeah.
And they were worried that no one would show up to Comic-Con because a lot of the actors, directors, and whatnot weren't going to show up. It was one of the best years to attend San Diego, in my opinion. So, you know, I think a lot of that comes from people just don't know how to – a lot of these Comic-Cons started as like a grassroots organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember going to San Diego. You could walk up to the door. You could buy a ticket for all 4 days. I remember going in there, and you could just walk up to guys like Jim Lee. You could walk up to guys like, Stan Lee. And it wasn't a big deal. And now it's just – they're so huge. And they've all become these sort of corporate for-profit events. And I sure do sort of miss those old days when it was just – it almost felt like friends getting together as opposed to half the city of San Diego or New York. You know what I mean? It's just a lot of people.
Well, the funny thing about San – we'll talk a little bit more about San Diego and then we got to get to your career. But the I was there – the first time I went there, I went to buy a ticket for the tram or whatever they call it. And I got there, and the lady looks up at me. She goes, "Are you going to the San Diego Comic-Con?" I said, "Yeah." "Oh, we don't like you around here," she goes. I said, "Wait a minute. This is the travel bureau, right?" And said, yeah, we don't – you know, we can't go downtown at all when you guys are here. It's completely taken over.
Jeez, I'm sorry we're bringing in billions of dollars to your economy.
That was kind of my rant. Now, the other flip side of that was one night I was on the tram going home, and I happened to be seated next to some of the ladies who were working in the food court areas and stuff like that. And I mentioned what happened. The lady said to me, "Oh, don't listen to her. She says, we love it when you come here. We wish you'd come every weekend. We'd make a lot of money if you guys came more often than you do." I said, "Well, I'll have to let that lady know that." I said, because she kind of – I was worried when I came – I'm coming down here going like, man, the people who live here don't want us here, and yet here we are.
But, I grew up in Las Vegas, and you know, tourism is 100% the economy in Las Vegas. And there was even talk for a while of moving San Diego to Las Vegas. And I know Las Vegas put in a serious bid because, you know, and I would imagine if you went and got a room at the Motel 6 in non-convention season, it would cost you $70. And during convention season, it would cost you like $500. Las Vegas doesn't really price gouge like that. There's such a volume of hotel rooms that you can't really do it. So, yeah, it's very alien to me to go to a city that doesn't want a giant convention in town because, you know, there's just so much money involved.
But if you go to New York, the interesting contrast from New York to San Diego, you go around and even people who shouldn't be wearing costumes are wearing costumes walking around downtown San Diego. You go to New York and you walk two blocks away from the Javits Center, they don't know the convention's going on.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very true.
I was so stunned, you know, because – and even when a guy dressed up like the Hulk got onto the subway and nobody paid attention to him. New York.
I lived in San Francisco while – you ride the public transit and so long as they're clothed, you're okay with it. I'll never forget there was one time I was sitting on the BART and there was this guy who just came through buck naked. Doing these acrobatics on the little handrails, you know. And usually when people perform, they have some way of collecting money. Like I remember people would walk through and they'd play the violin or they'd sing a song and they'd have their hat out. And I'm like, where's this guy?
He ain't got a hat on amongst other things.
So I would imagine, you know, they live in New York. They've seen it all. And keep your head down.
New York is still my favorite con because there's so much to do there and so many things you can find out. So I like that. San Diego is fun. I do like that. My problem with San Diego was the first time I went there, I did not exercise before I got there.
Oh, wow.
Big mistake. It took me a week to recover from walking all over, not only downtown San Diego, but within the convention center. So the hotels nearby, mm-hmm. up the hills to get to the Cartoon Network ice cream place, all this other stuff. I regretted that. I came home and all I could do was sleep for a week after that. It was something.
But for sure.
All right, let's get to your career. Why don't we?
Sure.
Kind of good things. How did you break into comics? Because it sounds like you have lots of great connections, particularly right now.
Well,
how did you get into it?
You know, I tried to break into comics ever since I was like 16. Hmm. And apparently the wrong way to do it is to submit to the actual, you know, how in the back of the books, they'd be like, if you're interested in drawing comics, you know, submit your samples to our submission editor. Hmm. Apparently no one ever got hired that way.
Hmm.
And so what I did is I sought out work from smaller publishers. I think my first couple of books were, well, I know my first couple of nationally distributed books were with Digital Webbing, which was, it started out as an online forum. And then a lot of people on the forum said, you know, hey, we got enough talent here on the forum. Why don't we do our own book? And so the creator of Digital Webbing, the website, his name is Ed Dukeshire. He actually put out, when I did my first work for him, I think it was like issue number 29. And then I did a feature called Fits of Justice Digital Webbing was an anthology. So I think I did like 8 pages of Fist of Justice for 8 to 16 pages of Fist of Justice for like the next 4 issues. And once I actually started getting published, then I was going, I've been attending San Diego Comic-Con since like 93, as soon as I could drive. I was basically driving to San Diego, and I knew that they had, like a talent workshop, like these panels. And so I started attending the panels, and in the panels, they're like, okay, this is how you submit here at the show. And so after a couple of years, I would take the independent pages and the independent books, and I actually put it in my submissions so the editors can see like, you know, hey, this is what I got published. So I think if you're trying to break in, maybe start small and then work your way up. I went from Boom to, I went to Digital Webbing to Boom to Dark Horse. I think I went back to Boom. Then I went from Dark Horse to DC. And then if you want to get work at Marvel, just start working at DC. They'll try and headhunt you. True story. Marvel, that's what Marvel does. They look for new names to pop up at DC, and then the first thing they do is try and come and say, hey, come work for us. And so if you want to know how to work for Marvel, get into DC. That's how that goes. And then I worked at DC for a very long time, but I was the fill-in guy. At both Marvel and DC, actually, I was the fill-in guy. I was the guy they called when the book was going to miss its diamond ship date, and I would bail everybody out of the fire, so to speak.
Wow.
My art got horrible reviews. Just, I'll never forget this one time. There was one book where I had like 7 days to do 22 pages. This is back when it was like 22 pages per featured book. And I hit the deadlines, the book shipped on time. I was the big hero at DC. And then Todd Klein, who has more Eisner Awards than anybody in the industry, reviewed my book and just tore me a new bunghole. I mean, just ripped me to shreds. And I had a really hard time with that for a long time. I was like, oh my God, you know. And of course, and that's if you ever pick up a book and you're not happy with the art, just tell yourself, like, I have no clue how much time this person had to work on it. Mm-hmm. I have no clue, because there was lots of times where if I had 2 weeks to finish a book, I was lucky. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. I was basically the fill-in guy for a very long time. And then I filled in for an artist on Warlord, and Mike Grell liked my drawing so much, he went to Joey Cavallari and said, "Hey, I want Chad to be the, you know, the series artist. You know, I don't want him working on other stuff. I want him to work on the series." And so Mike sort of took me in under his wing, and I did a lot of, I think we did like 14 issues of Warlord. And then I think Mike did the last two. I always say, I think, because anymore, the older I get, I don't trust my memory. So I don't want anyone coming at me, but I believe I did 12 issues of Warlord. Mike did the last two. And then Mark Wade invited me to come work with Stan Lee. So I actually went from DC back to Boom and worked with Mark Wade and Stan Lee on Traveler. And then Dark Horse called and wanted to know if I was interested in doing Star Wars. And I have three loves in my life: comic books, Star Wars, and Apple computers. And yeah, and so I jumped on that opportunity. And no sooner did I sign the contracts, did Lucasfilm sell the rights to Disney, and Marvel yanked the property back. And so I didn't get to do Star Wars. I did. I ended up doing Dragon Age, which I'm still very proud of my work on Dragon Age. But I worked with them for a year there. And then Joey Cavallari talked me into coming back to DC. I did a whole bunch of just little jobs for DC. But Joey's like, "Don't worry, I'm going to get you on a series. I'm going to get you on a series." And I remember that. I can't remember exactly the year it was. Probably 2012, 2011. I was expecting – I was doing fill-ins on Supergirl. So I was expecting to get a call from Eddie Berganza and, you know, basically be invited to be the full-time artist on Supergirl. And instead, I got a call from Mike Mertz saying, "Hey, do you want to come do Harley Quinn?" Now, I knew exactly who Harley Quinn was. I mean, I grew up on Batman, the animated series. I mean, huge fan. So I was like over the moon. Like, you know, she's one of my favorite characters, but this was the ironic thing. DC really didn't believe in the book. They were just like, "Yeah, you know, you'll probably do about 10, 12 issues and then we'll cancel you for, you know, low sales and whatnot." And, man, Jimmy and Amanda just, they killed it. I mean, I think that's a big reason why you saw a lot of like the Suicide Squad films, the Birds of Harley Quinn and the Birds of Prey. Because Warner Brothers was like, "Well, who's this character that's outselling Batman?" You know, and we were. I if memory serves, I think we went into reprint like five times on issue one. I think we were the first comic since Walking Dead to do that. So yeah, it was a huge success, and that was like drinking from the fire hose. Because I went from sort of this obscure, unknown artist that was, you know, and don't get me wrong, I've been doing, you know, I feel like my career has always sort of, you know, slowly been leveling up, but it's been a sort of a steady climb. And then with Harley Quinn, I felt like I got on a rocket ship and went to Mars.
So what, I mean, what kind of things changed for you when you started doing Harley Quinn?
Well, I went from like going to a convention and making a couple hundred bucks to going to a convention and just getting mobbed. I did, like, I swore to myself like I would never charge for a signature. And then I started having to charge for a signature, because what would happen is retailers would literally pull up a wagon full of comics to my table. And I would sign comics the whole entire convention, and then they wouldn't buy a print, they wouldn't buy a piece of artwork. And I'm just like going, "Well, why am I going to these conventions if, you know?" And so I find, and you know, I talked to Jimmy and Amanda. I was very lucky. Jimmy and Amanda, have you ever met Jimmy and Amanda? You ever talked to them?
Oh yeah, I've interviewed them.
Oh, yeah. they're the best people on the planet. Anyway, Jimmy's like, "Yeah, you got to charge." And that really worked out. And I keep it low. I think, so I still, if you want a book signed for me, if you want it personalized, I'll sign it for free. But now if you want a signature, it's $10. And if you want it CGC'd, it's $20. And it's simply because if you don't do that, then yeah, you're just going to be signing books the whole show and you're not going to make any money.
So, isn't that wild?
Yeah. It is.
It's amazing and stuff like that. But how's it go? Like if you went, when you went to MegaCon recently, how'd that go?
It was the same. Just really? You know, super busy. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's sort of changed since COVID, Whatnot has really picked up. Mm-hmm. I made double doing Whatnot sales at MegaCon than I actually did on the floor of MegaCon. Huh. So it's like 2/3 of my sales now are, you know, coming from Whatnot, and then 1/3 is coming from the convention. But one of the reasons why the convention Whatnot sales do so well is because there's so many people that cannot attend.
Right.
And if they can't attend, it's like they want to join a retailer who's there. And SMZ had like a giant suite set up at the Regency where they basically streamed the entire time.
Wow.
The whole show. And wow. So I would basically be on the floor during the day and then go draw over with them at night and just, you know, made it. And I don't want it to sound like, you know, all I care about is money, but if you're going to be taking away a weekend with your family, mm-hmm. you know, nobody's doing this for shits and giggles, pardon my French, mm-hmm. but you know, your time is valuable. Mm-hmm. And that's time that's taken away from work. That's time that's taken away from family. So if you're going to do these trips, if you're going to spend 4 days in Orlando, you got to make it worth your time. Mm-hmm. And absolutely. So, yeah. So for me, those shows, they're like a marathon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you talk about, well, just like you said, you went to San Diego, you walked all over the place. Well, for me, it's like I go to MegaCon or I go to San Diego or I go to New York. And instead of like maybe doing 2 or 3 commissions, which is what I normally do in a week, I'm probably doing 100.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
And that's why these art books are so valuable, mm-hmm. because every now and then you'll make a really great piece of art for someone's commission. And if you don't collect it, you don't photograph it, you don't scan it, then your fans are never going to get to see that piece. Mm-hmm. And so that's what these art books are. They're basically, you know, they're covers that and I'm going to show you the covers that got published, but for every cover that gets published, there's 4 or 5 comps that they reject. And lots mm-hmm. of times I feel like the editors pick the inferior pick the inferior comp. And mm-hmm. don't get me wrong, they have reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, editors look at things differently. You know, artists oh, yeah. have artist eyes, editors have other eyes. I'm 99% mm-hmm. sure, like right now, I'm doing it as soon as we finish this, I get the pencil a Deadpool cover tonight. So, mm. and I'm pretty sure the reason why Emily chose that comp is because basically it had great room for the logo, had great room for the barcode, it had great room for the, you know, all the stuff that they wanted to do, where the other ones, maybe they were, you know, artistically more compositionally pleasing or whatever, but something was going to get cropped by the logo or, you know, so, mm-hmm. you know, I don't question them, but lots of times there's some really great art that just never sees the light of day.
Well, cool. So now you get to put them in your book.
Yeah. And that's what's in the book. A lot of stuff that, like I said, commissions that I think turned out really well. In the Art of Chad Harden Volume 3, I did a gallery event called Heroes and Villains. Mm-hmm. Invited like Sal Velluto and all these different comic artists to basically come, and we created, mm-hmm. we turned the art gallery into a giant coloring book. Mm-hmm. We printed these giant comic panels all over the walls of the gallery. And then we gave the attendees basically paintbrushes to go in, and they got to color it. And it was the most successful event that the Woodbury Museum ever held.
Wow.
We had more people come to that event. And matter of fact, now the Woodbury's closed. Mm. So I get to say, you know, the most successful event ever held at the Woodbury Gallery in Orem, Utah was, you know, a comic exhibit that I curated and ran. So I know about those things, and maybe the people that attended the event in Orem, Utah know about them. But 99% of the rest of America and 100% of the rest of the world have no clue.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you something about that? Because you bring up a thing that always, and I realize this is going through the weeds and stuff like that. But if you do a commission for somebody, Do you have permission to put it in an art book later on? Or if they pay for this and you give this to them and you take a picture, I understand you putting it on social media and stuff like that, but do you retain the rights to put it into like an art book later on?
For sure, yeah. Anything an artist creates, okay, so copyright's sort of a tricky thing. Marvel and so whoever owns the character owns the copyright to that character. But anytime an artist creates an artwork, they own the copyright to the artwork. So there's actually a joint copyright. Now the person that owns the character can always come in and copy. And people need to remember that copyrights are enforceable at will. So if you get a call from DC and Marvel and they say, "Hey, knock it off," then you know you got to knock it off. But what happens with these books is, you know, basically you get implied consent, which is if you go to work for Marvel and DC, they basically know that they're not compensating their artists enough for artists. Like, I'll give you an example. I've never once received a penny for like workman's comp or Social Security from Marvel and DC. There's no benefits. It's just, you're a freelancer. Here's your contract. You give them the pages, they give you the money. But as far as like, you know, if you get sick, if you need time off, if you need a vacation, that's all on you. And so they know that artists basically need to come up with other ways. And so, you know, basically if you're doing drawings for them, they, you know, so long as you don't use a trademark, and so long, and the other thing they don't like is like it, if I were to take this book and I would put like 100% of Marvel stuff in it, Marvel would not like that. But if you basically break it up the way I'm doing it, where you're sort of getting a smattering of everything, you get a little bit more protection because it becomes like a showpiece for the artist. And anyway, so there's things in, you know, I think what it really comes down to is like with Adam Hughes. You know, Adam was so successful that basically DC went to him and said, "Hey, instead of doing this on your own, why don't we make you?" I don't know if you ever bought Cover Run, but you know, I mean, Adam would go to these conventions and just pull in insane amounts of money, and I think DC came to him and said, "Hey, if you're going to do this, why don't we do it officially?" And that's how the Cover Run was born.
Cool.
And then there was supposed to be Cover Run 2, but with all, you know, Bloody Monday and when AT&T bought DC and they just went through and just fired almost everybody, especially if they're long term. You know, Mark Chiarello was one of the people they let go to. I don't know who made that decision. I wouldn't have made that decision, but once he left, apparently so did Cover Run 2. So I don't know who's calling those shots now. I think I would pick – if it were me, I'd pick up that ball and run with it. But who knows? Who knows how they make those decisions? I think they're just leaving money on the floor. So.
Because it's really interesting to me because companies are doing that really now. I worked for a newspaper – if I said the name of it, people would recognize it. They went through and they basically gave buyouts to everybody who'd been there more than 5 years. And they basically – now people are glad they took it because the newspaper industry is basically dead.
Yeah.
But they – you know, I was one of the people that came later on. I didn't get as much as the first run. I was like the third or fourth. And I took a run. I took that and left. And boy, am I glad I did because – for once in my life, I looked and I saw a handwriting on the wall and I said, "I better get out of here." So I did. Well,
and I think the other thing that doubly hurt with the DC layoffs is, you know, the first thing they did is said, "Okay, if you want to keep your job, you got to move to LA." And I know a lot of, like Joey Cavallari, who gave me work for like 12 years. He didn't make that trip. He's just like, "No, I'm a New Yorker. I don't even have a driver's license. What am I going to do in LA?" And so he didn't make the trip. A lot of people didn't. And then can you imagine like moving from New York to LA, getting there, and then like, I don't know, a year later, AT&T just coming in and just, you know, I don't know. I don't know how they don't get sued, personally. I don't know.
Well, let me ask you, I'm kind of curious as to how do you decide? You said you have enough art for 4 and 5. How do you decide what art to put in which book?
Well, I wish I could say that I batted 1,000 every time. every time I pick up the pencil that that everything was just this, masterpiece. And I think I have a pretty good batting ratio. I don't soil the rug, so to speak, as often as I used to. But I do think every now and then you just have a sense where it's like, okay, I nailed this. Like this one turned out really good. And lots of times I'll take that piece of artwork, I'll turn it into a print, I'll turn it into some type of product. I'll put in an art book, and all wealth is generated through sales. Like if you're going to be an artist, that's great, but your money is not going to come from your art. Your money is going to come from the sale of your art. And so, you really have to learn to have sort of this business sense when you're creating artwork, and you have to know like what's valuable. And lots of times my fans get to decide what's valuable because usually before it appears in these art books, I've made it into a print or I've made it into a metal card like my newest hot selling print is I did this Ripley print. And she's in her spacesuit from the original Aliens, 1977, and the aliens sort of wrapped around her. I just wanted to do it, and I made it, and thank goodness the fans responded to it. But that's how you sort of know when you nail it, and you know, like, okay, well, obviously, if it's this well received, then it needs to be in this book. There's a lot of the fans basically get to decide, and then there's lots of times where I feel like there's this piece that I have put in that nobody responded to, and they should have. Matter of fact, that happens a lot, especially, I think that's one of the things that's so frustrating about creator owned. When I first started doing creator owned projects, for some reason, I thought that everyone that read my Harley books would come buy my creator owned books. And that's just not the case. Lots of times fans are fans of the character, not of the creator. Creator-owned works is really just it's its own thing, and you really have to get your own momentum going. I think some of the artwork that I've done for my creator-owned books, especially the interiors, some of the best artwork I've ever created, period, hands down. It's just a matter of getting people to see it now.
Well, I do have to say, I really think you do a terrific piece of art, particularly when it deals with the female figure.
Thank you.
I think it's really strong. And I think I always judge art on two things, on facial expressions and action sequences. And I think you're real strong on both of those. I think those are really dynamic. I remember one time when he was still with us, George Perez, I asked him, I said, how in the world do you come up with this? He had this picture and there were these lines running off the page and it just made it look all dynamic. He said, I don't know, it just pops into my head. He goes, and I said, wow. I said, that's a great place to have it pop into. And I'm grateful I've been alive when his stuff's going on because I just love his art. I think your art is also extremely strong and you tell stories very well. And I think that's something that's why I think you can sell 4 volumes of artwork.
Well, thank you. I think a lot of that came from rejection because really? So the Marvel and DC editors that, the submission editors for that little mail in at the back of the book, I never got work from them, but I always got encouragement and instruction. And I always listened to that. And so I bought all of Will Eisner's books and I just studied them. And he has a great book called Comics in Sequential Art that I used to teach. I actually have an MFA in making comic books, and I actually taught for 6 years at Utah Valley University. Oh, wow. I taught students how to make comics. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't let me use Will Eisner's book as my textbook because of, well, it's dated. You know, there's mm-hmm. there's depictions of different races that today's audience finds, you know, offensive.
Yeah. But
I would always tell my students, I said, listen. There's gold in them there hills. And you really need to know this stuff. So, you know, just be forewarned. Yeah, there's going to be some dated concepts in there. But, you know, when this came out, it was wildly progressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you got to judge things according to their era and their mm-hmm. setting. You need to understand the context of the age.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, anyway, so I poured over that. I still think I love Stan. I love Stan Lee. I'm not mm-hmm. besmirching him whatsoever, but mm-hmm. how to draw Marvel Comics. If you took out his text and put in a serious text, like if you just let John Buscema write that, I think it'd be one of the greatest art books ever written.
Mm-hmm.
Hands down. But I think what happened is, you know, Stan got this and he said, well, let's make it for sixth graders. And you know what? It worked. That's how old I was when I picked it up out of the library. I was in sixth grade. But those lessons, there's lessons in that book that artists with MFAs are completely 100% clueless about. So they're, you know, anyway, there's a lot. There's great books on gesture drawing. Chris Legespi, I think is his name. When I taught gesture, I highly referenced his books. Framed Ink by, I'm pulling a brain fart. Anyway, there's a lot of books out there that I felt, even when I wasn't working in comics, I was just pouring over them and studying them and studying them and stuff. And I was a fan too. I read everything. I used to work in a comic book shop and they would pay me $2 an hour and all the comic books I could walk out of with on Friday. And, and I made a killing.
Wow.
I mean, I think they thought I would take like a handful of books. No, I would pull up to the front door. I'd park my truck in front of the front door of the comic book store. I'd open the door to my truck. I'd open the door to the comic book store, and I would stack comics from my chin, you know, like as long as I could stretch my arms and just make a beeline. And I'm not kidding. I think I have every comic book from like 1989 to current.
Wow. You know?
Well, and that's the other cool thing when you start – DC and Marvel stopped doing this, but it used to be when you were an artist for Marvel and DC, they would give you comps of everything they published that month.
Right. I read
so,
that.
So, yeah. So I worked for both of them I worked for Marvel and DC. I basically did a book a month for Marvel and a book a month for DC. Almost for a couple years until I basically went to Boom to do, to work with Mark Waid and Stan Lee. And so for those 2 years, I have absolutely every single issue that came out and then when I went back to DC, they did the same thing. I have everything that came out from like Rebirth and New 52. And I think it was about the middle of the run of Rebirth where they just said, we're going to just give you a Comixology account. And I can't tell you how pissed I was. I was like, oh, man, you know. But, yeah.
Well, I remember the Rebirth days when there were lines to get into the – was it New 52? Which I forget which one it is. They revamped so many times now, I forget.
Yeah.
I think it was New 52 maybe. Where people were in long lines waiting to get in on release day and stuff like that. And I haven't seen that since. But
yeah.
Those are fun times and stuff. Well, Chad, I have to say that it's The Art of Chad Harden, Volume 4.
Yeah.
And hopefully Volume 5 sounds like is in the works. And if you go to zoop.gg/C as in cat/Chad Harden 4, the number 4, and you'll get to the page, and it's going to conclude by the end of March, about the 28th, we figure, roughly. So be sure to get – and just – there's so much more I would love to ask you. We've got to do this again because there's just so much fun to talk with you and talk comics with you about these good things. It's sometimes I struggle with artists because you guys think visually, and I don't, and I have to kind of think in along your lines and do it. But you are so much fun to talk with about this. I would love to do this again. Hopefully when the volume 5 comes out, maybe we can talk again, because it's just great. I just hope this is a huge success. So this, maybe you won't even have to do volume 5. You'll have enough money from 4 to do both of them. That'd be great.
You know, I even if I had the money, I still think I told my wife's like, well, what's your retirement plan? I said, I got the Alex Toth retirement plan. I'm going to draw until I drop. I think if I had all the money in the world, I'd still be drawn. But yeah,
well, that's good for us though.
You know, I do it 'cause I love it. Mm-hmm. You know, I trust me, if it was for money, there are a million professions out there where you're going to make more money. Mm-hmm. Artists do it for the love of the art. And
well, you don't have to say that. I was a fan of the Peanuts strip, and Charles Schulz did it for decades and decades and decades. All of a sudden, he announced he was going to stop, and it was so sad. It was like almost days after he stopped that he passed.
Yeah.
And well, I wonder if that was because he stopped. I mean, if he was still going, would he still be around drawing peanuts and making peanuts? Because it was the weirdest thing.
Well, my understanding is that Neil Adams was finishing up his commission list on his deathbed. Like he knew he was dying. And his goal was to get through his commission list. And you know, I can't remember where I heard that. But I heard it from someone who knew Neil enough that I took it seriously. And
I'll tell you a quick story about him. I was interviewing him for this podcast, and it was at a convention. I took my little recorder over with it. He said, let's do it before the floor opens so we can get it done. So I'm over there. We're talking. I've got my little recorder going. Some dealer comes over and wants him to sign a bunch of stuff. You should have seen the look that Neil gave him. I thought he was going to pass on the spot. Oh, my goodness. You know, and he said, come back later. And you can edit that out, right? So, yeah, this is good. We'll keep going. So he was a great guy.
Neil was a personality. That's for sure. He was a very strong personality. We could have a whole podcast, I'm sure, just on Neil Adams stories. I'm sure.
That's great stuff. Well, Chad, I have to say, it's been so much fun. Before I let you go, are there places on social media where people can follow you?
Yes. Okay. So Harden_art on Instagram is my most popular social media. That's going to have links to my Facebook and my Threads account. I'm Chad Harden on X, or formerly Twitter, whatever you want to call that. I'm launching my website with Murphy Ledke. So my Shopify store will be open on Friday. You can go to either hardencomics.com or chadhardenart.com. Either one of those links will take you straight to my Shopify store starting on Friday. And then we have Zoop. I'm trying to think of what other, I'm on like Blue Sky and all that stuff, but I can't remember I can't keep it all straight, man. I should have brought a little cheat sheet, but,
It's okay.
Just look for it. Just type in Chad Harden and usually I pop up. I'm not one of these guys that have the avatar although I shouldn't besmirch anyone, because especially female creators will use, avatars because of harassment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I used to be like, why aren't these people using their real name? And then you find out they had a stalker. You're like, oh, geez, maybe I should shut up because I don't know what I'm talking about. But well, yeah,
I went to a Star Trek convention once, and Jeri Ryan was there, and I wondered why she got on stage with two guards.
Yeah,
and found out later she had a stalker after her, and she didn't even trust going on stage at a Star Trek convention without guards up there. So you got to be careful. I hate to say it, but But Chad, it's been so good talking with you and just wonderful. I wish you much success. I think this is going to just blow the roof off and you're going to have all kinds of great stretch goals. And volume five, I'm happy is coming. And I want to get your other good things as they come out. So it sounds, as I said, you're a busy guy and that's good for us. So Chad, I just wish you much success and man, just keep going. And I don't want you on your deathbed doing commissions though. I'd rather you didn't do that, but just keep doing the wonderful stuff you're doing. Cause I think obviously the fans are responding and that's great.
Thank you. I hope so. And I do want to thank my fans for making this possible. Because I really don't know what I would do if I wasn't doing this. This is always my goal since I was since I started reading comics, being a comic book. I remember picking up X-Men Annual number 10 by Arthur Adams and looking at that artwork and saying, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I get to do it. And every day I get to do it, I feel blessed. And it just wouldn't happen without my fans. So hats off to everybody. Thank you so much. And you keep buying it. I'll keep drawing it. There you go.
Sounds great.
Thanks. All right, bud.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance. The Holy Reich had fallen, leaving the galaxy in chaos. It was a perfect storm for those who trafficked in blood and war. It was the age of the Death Slinger. And right now I'm talking with the writer of Death Slinger, Shane Berryhill. How you doing, Shane?
I am doing great, Wayne. It is a pleasure to be here on the Wayne Comics Podcast, part of the Major Spoilers Network. It's an honor, a privilege. Thank you. Thanks to your listeners for all you do for the medium of comics. We can't just thank you enough.
Well, I appreciate getting all the good words in there for Major Spoilers and all those kinds of things. Always a good thing to promote the boss and other kinds of things like that. So it's pretty good. Now, before we get too far into it, I want to make sure there's other books that you have had a book that came out called Comic Books Kill. It came out from Scout Comics, and there I have to give my little speech. I had zero to do with this book, although I sometimes help out behind the scenes with Scout Comics. The reason why this book is so much better is because I had nothing to do with it. Do you want to talk about, once before we go into the things, what is Comic Books Kill about?
Well, again, Comic Books Kill is from Scout Comics, and I know Scout has had a little bit of bad press of late, but my personal experience with Scout has been nothing but good. I think it's a case of, you know, they've admittedly, since they've had some creators complain, they've owned up to, you know, dropping the ball on a couple of things and have tried to be transparent about that. And are just trying to mend fences and build relationships. But again, personally, my experience has been great. So that out of the way, that said, Comic Books Kill, it's 1939, Golden Age comics creator Jack Levi enters into an illustrious love affair with the femme fatale mistress of his mob boss back publisher. So, in other words, you know, Comic Books Kill, it plays upon the age-old rumor that Golden Age comics served as a front for the mafia. And so what we do, we tie in the fact, you know, using that just as a springboard to tell a entertaining story of these two unlikely bedfellows, crime and comics, that the mafias are using the trucks that bring in the comics from the cheap Canadian publishers into the States to bring in heroin. And so it just kind of throw in that secret love affair and, you know, all HE double hockey sticks eventually breaks loose, Wayne, if I do say so. So But if you know your comics history, you're gonna see tons of Easter eggs in there. And it's a book I'm really proud of. The artist and co-creator is Hoyt Silva, and who's done some work with Scout and others. And so just really super proud of this book.
Yeah, he does a lot of great comics, Hoyt does. So really good stuff. Now, the other book that you're, before we get to that, Slinger, is that Jason and the Olympians, right?
Yes, sir. Jason and the Olympians from Band of Bards. Alex Ogle is my co-creator on that and also a letterer and graphic designer. He's done some licensing art for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He did an alternate cover for Amazing Spider-Man number 75. But anyway, Jason and the Olympians, the elevator pitch is imagine a world where the gods of Greek myth not only actually existed, but continue to coexist with humanity up until about 100 years into our future, when the titans of myth, or actually the alien of the dark alien menace behind the legend of the Titans, return, wipe out Earth, Jason and what's left of humanity escape aboard the starship Olympia, and Jason and her team of demigoddess clones must use giant robot colossi to form the giant automaton protector Talos to defend the last of humanity. Humanity's last hope, Wayne, is Jason and the Olympians. as you can tell by the description, the book's a love letter to super giant robot genre. Everything from Mazinger Z to Voltron to Power Rangers, you name it. And the fresh take on it is being that young empowered females are the, while they're usually a token character in that kind of book, they take the limelight in Jason and the Olympians.
Now, before I let you get off of this book, spell Jason.
It's J-A-C-I-N, and that is short for Jacinta. It's just a little play because Jason is actually of mixed heritage in the book, Japanese and Portuguese. Again, it's available in print on from bandofbards.com. You can read it on Global Comics. And my publisher informs me it is a huge hit on the Comics Plus app for, I think it's called Library Pass. I may be getting those two mixed up, but super proud about that.
Wow.
So just very excited, and we're about to finish up volume two at present. Me and the creative team, illustrator Mattia Monaco, colorist Mayo Pasek, and again, Alex is my co-creator.
Oh, boy, I appreciate the pronunciation there on people's names, because those are the beautiful names that I have trouble pronouncing.
Oh, wait, let me tell you, I usually apologize, and I probably should now every time, because like Mattia, he is an Italian artist, and he and I have never even met or talked or anything, just emailed and messaged. And the same thing with Maya, who is, they're just both phenomenal talents, and I'm just so glad they just breathe such life into Jason and the Olympians and anything they touch, frankly. Just excited to have them.
Do they speak English? Are they Italian or something?
Well, Maya's from New, although she's moved to the, I think she's in Eastern Europe at present, and there natively. I think she lived in New Jersey for a while, but oh, wow. I think she's moved back over there. And Mattia, again, he's Italian, but yes, they both communicate English just fine.
Oh, great, because it reminds me of a story I'll tell you real quickly. I was in college, and this guy from Eastern Europe had come, but he didn't speak English. Hmm. He wanted to learn English. So what he did was, I had my twin brother and I were in the room next to him. He brought a tape recorder over, and he wanted us to, and he brought a book. He says, I want you to read over there so I can hear what American English sounds like. And so we did that for him, and he was learning. And then he went off somewhere else for a while, and a couple of years later he comes back. And he talks to me, and he comes up to me and says, oh, hey, Wayne, how you doing? Oh, no, I said, I've cursed you. I said, you sound like me now. Oh, that's fine. I sound American. Yeah, but you're me American. You should have your own American sound. Yeah. No, it's fine. I fit right in perfectly. I said, I have done such terrible damage to you. You know, you don't know what damage I've done to you.
Yeah. Wait, there's a bright side to that story. It wasn't me providing that tape because, as you can tell, my from my nasal twang, I hail from the southeastern United States.
That's okay. Well, I hail from the northeastern, and up in Pennsylvania, northeast coal mining country, we have our own specific way of pronouncing things. One of the, as you can notice right there, we drop our G's. We always swear at the – if you go around Pennsylvania, all over on the floor everywhere, all these G's – because we're talking and walking and driving and moving, but there ain't no G's on the end of any of the stuff we say. So there's all, if you drive around, you're running over G's all over on the roads and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, same thing down here, man. Just a little more draw, plenty of coal mining country, and probably, you know, a little more nasally is all.
I still feel sorry for that guy. I hope he's not sounding like me somewhere. I hope he's picked up his own way of seeing it now. Because, oh, my goodness. The moment I heard him, I was like, oh, no. Oh, no. So anyway, all right. Let's get on to it. Let's move us from that. We'll go right to Death Slinger. Now, I have noticed a common thing that you often have women in prominent roles. Now, Comic Book Kills, of course, is around a guy who I strongly imagine is Jack Kirby-esque.
You nailed it on the Comic Book Kill. It's we actually call him Jack Levi, which is Jack Lee would have been a little too on the nose if you follow. So, but go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay, because he I'm so interested in. We've got the female, of course. The female is a bombshell, and basically everybody is drooling all over the. They have to mop the floor up every time she sings because there's drool all over the floor. And stuff like that. And she gets involved in stuff and things go all over the place from there. But Jason, of course, is a female in the Olympians and there's all kinds of good things going on with that. The Death Slinger is a female. I read a little bit of the description from there. Do you want to talk a little more about Death Slinger so we can explore it a little further?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And you were talking about that femme fatale mistress just a second ago. That, again, that's in Comic Books Kill. Young Jason, she is a teenage polymath, a prodigy, and human. And then, again, she has demigoddess clone teammates, which are all a very far cry from our title character in Death Slinger, whose name is Gen E 666, who it's Gen E as in Generation E. She is a basically, as you said in your intro there, Wayne, this takes place after basically a galactic civil war. And whereas Jenny, a Death Slinger, was basically a cybernetic, a soldier, a killer assassin for basically what was an evil empire. Called the Holy Reich in the book. And now that the Reich has fallen and she's escaped, she's found herself masterless. So like all the samurai movies and spaghetti westerns that I grew up watching that inspired Death Slinger, that and the B-movie sci-fi that I so love, she's like a masterless Ronin. She's basically a living weapon. And so she's making her way through the galaxy, using her, skills, as a hired gun, as a hired weapon. She is female, but, she's only partially human, but she's trying to be a better person. Sometimes she succeeds, sometimes she does not.
Now this comes out from Cosmic Lion Productions, right?
Yes, sir. Cosmic Lion Productions. It's available at the publisher on their website for pre-order right now, March in March 2024. The book will drop in print this May. My co-creator and artist, who just really brought this work to life, who is amazing, is Ben Perkins. He's done several projects with the Cosmic Lion team, most notably Ghost Agents. He's been a contributor to anthologies like that and other works. The backbone of our team was a good friend of mine, actually, who lives in my area, as does Alex Ogle, my co-creator on Jason. But as far as Death Slinger, our graphic designer and letterer, Keith Finch. And you can follow Ben the artist on Instagram. It's at Bratty Ben, BRATTYBEN. And then also to get all what Keith's working on, you can find him on Instagram via at Real, R-E-A-L, Keith Finch, F-I-N-C-H. Keith is a corporate graphic designer by day and a crime-fighting wrestler known as the Blue Jefe by night, as well as a graphic designer. So,
are you serious?
Only partially.
Okay. Please.
He is a huge wrestling fan, and I think I've seen some pictures of him. I think they had like a Halloween day at the office where he works, and he dressed up in a blue business suit, a luchador mask, and cape. And and one of my favorite—I'm jumping ahead here, Wayne—but one of my favorite things about Deathslinger, it's a graphic novel. And we have chapter bookends and some back matter, and part of the back matter I write like a faux article from an unreal publication called The Comics Journalist, which wherein they interview Keith as his Blue Jefe character, and because Deathslinger is such it's grim and gritty subject matter. It's hardcore, ultra violence, in the funnest ways. And we can talk more about that in a second. But after all that, you know, I wanted a bit of comedic release at the end. So, you know, I've got, some faux articles with Keith, one with me where I'm exchanging emails with a movie producer, scripting Deathslinger, the movie, which, you know, just showcases every horror story of Hollywood you've ever heard and just things like that. Just trying to make it fun and lighten stuff up at the end.
Well, as I told you before we started to talk, there's something I've never seen in a comic before that's in this book. If you get to the title page, you've got the credits on the left, but you've also got a few words from the creators. Says the makers and producers of this comic do not condone or promote real world violence. Deathslinger is merely a work of fiction and meant solely as entertainment. And then we go down the ways to avoid real life conflict. Yeah. Take a deep breath, pause when needed, acknowledge how you're feeling, and know it's okay to not feel okay. And we get 7 of those. And I have never seen that in a comic before.
Yeah.
Is that. Were you worried that somebody was going to pick up this book and actually start punching other people with it?
Well, not. I mean, you know, there is this old saying that, you know, what is it fiction doesn't create killers. It makes killers more creative. And that's probably true for the most part. But, you know, I just didn't want to, you know, I think Deathslinger, again, admittedly, it is it's an ultra violent fantasy, and it's meant as, like I said, entertainment, as fun. It's a good way, you know, Carl Jung talked about how we all have our shadow selves, which encapsulates everything we're not, which for most people is probably those dark impulses of, and I think, you know, fiction model used healthily can be a good way to exercise, you know, a healthy, cathartic way to exercise those dark impulses. But we never, ever wanted to jump to reality. And so we just thought, you know, especially with the content and just, you know, the name itself, Deathslinger, we wanted to make it super clear that this is, you know, this is just meant as entertainment and nothing else. It is not an old to battle or anything like that. And that would be the last thing on earth any of the creative team would ever want. We just want you to go in there. You know, if you've had a bad day, you can't, like you said, punch a hole in the wall, or you shouldn't, or shoot a hole in the wall. But with Deathslinger, you can go in there and vicariously get that out of your system and breathe a sigh of relief. And then, you know, be back to normal after. That's our intention.
Well, I have to say, as many times as I've watched Bugs Bunny drop an anvil on the top of somebody's head, I've never been tempted to do that in real life.
Right, right.
So I grew up in an era when those kinds of things were, you would see those things and we laugh hysterically because, nah, it'll never happen.
Right.
So for me, when I saw that, I was like, okay. I actually took it as a laugh because I was like, I don't know anybody who's watched a cyborg, and she is a cyborg basically, go around and shoot up people and then decide it's time to go shooting other people. Because that's, in my head, I differentiate entertainment versus real life. And I never to this day. This is why I like murder mystery stuff, because I, for the life of me, I don't know why people do these things. But
Yeah. So, well, I'm the same way. Like, you know, again, I think we all have this morbid fascination. And I think if you repress it and don't embrace it, then that's can often be when it does become a problem. But just to echo your point, you know, most people can differentiate between, you know, reality versus unreality, mm-hmm. fantasy. Mm-hmm. So as long, but you know, I can't speak for everyone. I don't want to, you know, so I just want to make, we just want to make it 100% clear where we stood on the matter. So
you're covering your bases.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. We would never want to be a tool or something to instigate such. We just, again, we're just comics. We're just entertainment. And that's all. We are not soapboxing with Deathslinger. It's just supposed to be an enjoyable read. End of story. Pun intended, Wayne.
Okay. All righty. So where did the idea for Deathslinger come from?
Oh, well, like I said, it's on a steady diet of a lifetime of spaghetti westerns, Sergio Leone, Sergio Corbucci, and then all the Akira Kurosawa movies that you can shake a stick at, Wayne. You know, I still love that stuff. And periodically, of all the movies, I've probably gone back and watched those over and over my life the most. They're just pure story. Mm-hmm. You know, a good example of that, how you can reinterpret it, you know, the last, that Mad Max Fury Road, or all of them, that's just, and if you like Mad Max, you're going to love Deathslinger. But that's basically, that followed the tropes, the storyline of basically a Western. You know, the mysterious man wanders into town, saves the day, and then wanders out.
Yeah.
You know, so that's every Western I ever grew up on, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just that. And again, I came up with the world, the characters, and the story. But as far as the look of the world, the creation of the characters, that's all Ben Perkins. He actually, you know, totally his original creations, just how he wanted to spin them. And just make them, and he's done a fantastic job. I can't praise Ben enough, and all the polishes and touches that Keith put on it, just amazing stuff.
Well, I have to say, I love the artwork, but the very first page, she's saying, "Father, I had another one of my special dreams." She's in like a place, and the machinery is like being constructed. You know, arms and legs and stuff like that. But on the other half of the page is where I kind of felt sorry for Mr. Perkins. He's got all these shells. She's shooting a rapid-fire gun, and I can't count all the shell casings. They're flying out of that gun.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, wow. Again, yeah, Ben did an amazing job. And that initial page you're referring to, that's kind of our, you know, especially when you're doing indie comic books, like, although it's not even that certain for, you know, the major publishers these days. But you typically, you know, if you're writing Batman or Spider-Man, you know, you've got, you know, at least a year of 12, 22 to 20 page comics to tell your story in.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Warner Brothers and Disney are ultimately fitting the bill for that. But mm-hmm. budget technically is not a worry. But, you know, indie comics, we're working with a micro budget by comparison.
Right.
So we have limited real estate. But what I try to do with that humbly, Wayne, I think we did with Deathslinger and more, is, you know, that makes you more creative. And just how, so that one page you're referring to, you know, that's almost a visual origin story of Jenny 666 right there. Mm-hmm. That it doesn't get bogged down by tons of exposition. You know, you see her getting created, then you see what she was created for and what was happening. And then, boom, by page two, you're into the story and you're off and running.
So when does this all take place?
Well, I used, and I'll be honest with you, I pulled there is a sequence in the, I think it's chapter four of the graphic novel, I think it's chapter five, if memory serves, that's shown through Jenny's point of view. So you've got kind of like a little readout. I think it says like star date 2366. So, you know, a couple, 200 or 300 years technically in what would be our future. Although if Disney's attorneys won't come after me, I'll say it could take place in long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, or, you know, or in the future. So, you know, it's just, you know, just considered a timeless space epic. But, you know, we made a conscious decision early on, which we won't rule out. You may see it to keep it a more dirty, bare bones future. Like, you know, just because of the cool visual aesthetic, we decided off the bat, you know, we wanted to use guns that fire, you know, real bullets, real shells versus laser guns or something like that, because it's just more raw, more visceral, and just more in line with the vibe we're going for. Much more aliens, James Cameron's aliens than Buck Rogers. So if that makes a sense as far as, you know, the aesthetic. Mm-hmm.
Well, it kind of also looks like a potential future with not only is she basically a cyborg, it looks like almost everybody else has lots of artificial parts
Yeah. Well, that's, and I try to make that clear in the intro coming in that, like you're referring probably to some of the secondary characters, the repairman and Magpie, who. Mm-hmm. I try to make it clear that although they do appear to look kind of human, they're actually androids in full versus Jenny, who's a cyborg. And while it's maybe I didn't do my job well enough, Wayne. But yeah, I mean, what we kind of created, you know, and to make a good story, like really. You're getting the tip of the iceberg of the world with Deathslinger. Like I have such a backstory, and for future volumes, just the what's going on, you know, outside the world that Jenny's on, the history, the Holy Reich, the conglomerate, these warring forces, you know, and I don't even get to dig into, what are basically anti-technology, a church, a religious sect that exists in this universe, which we're just going to call the Luddites. And then all over this world, which, you know, again, we didn't really get to play into much, are just these stranded things of technology, which I playfully call Olmecs. As an old, which is a play on words like old mechanisms and the Olmec, Native or South Americans, the Olmecs there, which alludes to this ancient civilizations that have been existed on these worlds prior to Genie, the Holy Reich, or any of it, but traces of them are still there. So just to kind of give you a scope, you know, like, Lord of the Rings might be a good analogy, how, you know, you see Middle Earth through Gandalf's through, you know, Aragorn and the Hobbits, but man, centuries have spanned in that world prior to them and to come. So
that's something I guess you could pay attention to is when the main character talks, the word balloons are like straight lines, but when I guess the mechanized people come, they don't have straight lines going to the person talking. It's sort of, it's almost mechanical. I guess that's the way to show that, how that works. Yeah, they still act human, though.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, it's something we're approaching to, ironically, in our own day and age. The lines, but thanks to Chap PT, which I can't even say right, but sorry. But the lines between AI and actual humanity are blurring, and you see that in Deathslinger. And you mentioned those word balloons. That's Keith, again, that's Keith Finch's work. All his letterer and graphic designer, just all the flourishes he put in, and just to make this look unique and, you know, really handcrafted. It was just a very nice touch. So,
you know what else I'm intrigued by are the eyes, particularly the Deathslinger's eyes.
Yeah,
they're kind of reverse from you've got black, and where most of our eyes are white, and that makes it look very different. And of course, very expressive the way that's done there. I think that's really something. But boy, when they get down to action, let me tell you, there's action.
Yeah, buddy. And again, that's Ben Perkins, the artist, those are all his touches, his decisions on on how to make. He's also he's penciler, inker, and colorist, Wayne. So you know, he did all the heavy lifting on Deathslinger. I can't thank Ben enough for just using his talent toward the project as my co-creator. And when it was time to bring the action thunder, Ben delivered and then some.
You know what else I like? There are like wanted dead or alive posters. And I like it because if you ever try to take a picture far away and you try to blow it up, you get things are all really grainy. And if you look at those two, the pictures are super grainy, which makes me think of every time I try to, people send me a picture and say, blow that up. And I blow it up and I go, I can't even hardly tell what it is. And that's the way with that is it's super grainy. So obviously they're blowing up somebody's faraway picture. It's as close as they could get without getting killed, apparently.
Yeah, well, and that's a good way to look at it, Wayne. Again, that was what you're referring to is some of the, like we have chapter bookends that just kind of really expand the world. And when we were talking about those wanted posters, Keith and myself, Keith, I owe all the credit. We were like, hey, let's make something, you know, what kind of technology would be hanging, you know, in this ghost town on a backward, lawless world? And, you know, I said maybe something, you know, that was, you know, a glitchy and, you know, almost like an 8-bit 1980s Atari game, you know, just for fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so we just thought it'd be a cool touch to add that, you know, make that the gritty space age cheapo lo-fi version of a wanted poster.
Mm. You know, the one thing that I always puzzle over capes and stuff like that. I puzzle over her hair. She's got bright magenta hair that pokes way up. And fortunately, it manages to stay out of her eyesight most of the time.
Yeah.
But how can she have hair that long?
Well, again, that's all Ben Perkins' choice. And fun fact, Ben is a huge Eric Larson Savage Dragon fan. So I wonder if that's not just like a little homage to the dragon in Mr. Larson's work.
Mm-hmm. So that makes sense.
I don't want to speak for Ben, but that and you know, I need to ask him, Wayne, but that's kind of been my suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no, there's a whole bunch of characters, and I don't want to spoil things, but let's just say.
Spoil away, Wayne. Spoil away.
Oh well, we get to see the first Deathslinger, but people should expect that's not the only Deathslinger we're going to see in the book.
Yeah, that's right. Again, we were talking about how this world has a history to it, and. I'll take the long way around to talk about the Deathslinger you're referring to. You know, basically the Deathslingers or the squads of them were weapons for, again, the now fallen Holy Reich. The conglomerate won the war. I won't go into for spoiler's sake of how that happened. You kind of get to see that in the book in a flashback sequence. And the conglomerate was basically this uber capitalist society. And they took, so rather than, you know, delete all the Death Slingers or terminate them, you know, like, hey, they were basically, hey, come for work in our private army, which is kind of a nod to like what the Allied forces did with Project Paperclip. In a way, if you're familiar with your World War II history, like Wernher von Braun, I mean, the guy who created, you know, the basically the foundation, the technology we use for our NASA rockets, he was a Nazi. He was mm-hmm. a Nazi. Mm-hmm. And and there's many others like that. So mm-hmm. I kind of use that as my springboard to say, well, they probably, you know, they've got these valuable weapons. They wouldn't just get rid of them or not mm-hmm. all of them. So mm-hmm. so anyway, another Death Slinger pops up mm-hmm. in the course of the story. You're absolutely
yep.
right.
Yep. Yep. And let's say chaos ensues. Probably the best way to say it. But there's all kinds of great things going on. I almost want to say the subtitles should be Heads Will Roll, but I don't think they get to the floor very often.
Yeah, it's definitely a shoot 'em up and more. Like you said, it's just operatic violence. You know, just you should read this comic and just hear the bracka 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 of guns, the casings falling on the floor, mm-hmm. and you know, if you can have that visceral experience, then we've all done our job, because that's what we really wanted with Death Slinger.
So this first edition, this is how many pages? It's 80 pages.
Well, yeah, we cheat on that a little bit for full transparency, for fun of it, because, you know, I loved reading, you know, those DC 80-page giants in my youth. So I love saying, we've got an 80-page giant. Now, that admittedly is including the front cover and the back cover. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, 80 pages. And so you've probably got, you know, yes, it includes the front cover and back cover, 80 pages. Because it's all eye candy, all reading material.
How much does it sell for?
It is $20. It's $20.
Okay, because it doesn't say anything on the cover or the inside page that I see. So it's good to know that.
Yeah, Eli Schwab, the our publisher, our visionary, who you know, did have vision enough to pick up Death Slinger. He actually is just back as of, I think it's this week, from the very first IC3, Indie Comics Creator Con in New Haven, Connecticut. And he actually had an IC3 20 copy exclusive for that convention. And wow. They went like hotcakes. I'm eager to say.
Wow.
So $20 there. So that in all that to come back, circle back around, Wayne, and say what you and thank you again for taking time to read this book. The version you got, of course, just the e-version, had not had the price put on it yet. So
okay, someday you ought to have a contest, and if somebody can count all the shell casings in this book and able to tell you exactly how many shell casings there are in this book.
Yeah. For those of us who indulge, that would be a great drinking game, actually. Yeah.
Cause even on the cover, if you look, she's falling, but she's shooting up above her. And it's like raindrops. All these, all the shell casings are gone. So it's something. Did we ever find out her origin in this story, or is that we that one panel pretty much sums it up?
Well, it does. Now again, but I I'll talk about that. I want to just jump back to that cover you mentioned, and thank you for that. Ben was kind of channeling his inner Jeff Darrow there, and he said, you know, Shane, my idea was to have, you know, it literally raining bullets. So man, that's
for sure. Very and, good.
Those like you get a present day narrative story throughout the course of the book, but at those chapter bookends where we've got faux letters and emails between characters and stuff like that, that kind of fleshes out her story, and it's kind of implied there is one from a Holy Reich doctor who was part of Project Death Slinger, who was created the Deathslingers, kind of explains Jenny's origin story, as well as just basically all the Deathslingers. And I liken it to kind of like what they did with Watchmen, for lack of a better comparison. Not that I'm ever would consider myself in league with Alan Moore or others, but I'm just saying I kind of use that model, and rather than stick it all, you know, we put it between the chapters. And each bookend relates to the chapter before it directly. So it kind of just helps flesh out the world and the story. It's not essential. You can skip over them if you like, but if you do read those chapter bookends, it's definitely going to enhance and enrich your reading experience when it comes to Deathslinger.
And you get to stretch your, what's the word I want? You get to stretch your scribe talents when it comes to actually just writing without necessarily having illustration with it.
Well, that's true enough. But I mean, again, like we said, we wanted to make sure, you know, it, like you said, the price is $20 and we want to make sure people are getting their money's worth. So, you know, we wanted to give them something they could chew on. Again, it was a creative challenge. We talked about that limited indie comics budget versus, you know, something, you know, because I'm just a dude, Wayne, with a wife and family and mortgage. So, mm-hmm. and bills on top of that to pay. I don't have the backing of Warner Brothers or Disney. But, you know, so if people are going to shell out the same kind of their hard-earned cash, I want to make sure that they've got something, you know, that they can read and enjoy and tide them over and just give them a great experience and make them feel like their money was well spent. So
there's a great sentence on the back, I guess, inside back cover. It says, "Bullets will fly and bodies will fall," it says. So that's pretty good summation of what the... It is a back cover. I get a big kick out of that. I thought that was kind of fun. So this is a great book. If you enjoy action and daring do and female lead characters, I think this is going to be one that you want to be sure to get. So you're saying this is the first half of the story?
Oh, it's just the first volume. I've already written volume 2. And Ben and company, of course, is on tap to do it. In the future, but this is just volume 1. Jenny's ventures lay ahead. I can just as I'll give you a little teaser. Our next volume is subtitled Desolation, and it kind of takes, you know, and I, you know, we want to give it, make it something fresh. So, you know, this kind of takes volume 1 takes place kind of in a more arid desert climate, ghost town, your stereotypical Western town, whereas volume 2 is going to take place, you know, in the Arctic zones of the planet, this moon that Jenny's on. So I would sum up my elevator pitch would be, what would it be? From Dusk Till Dawn meets, John Carpenter's Thing. Speaking of John Carpenter, but yeah, we've really had a great response so far to volume 1. We've gotten, and you mentioned the back cover. I don't know if they're all on the edition that you have, Wayne, but mm-hmm. we've gotten great cover blurbs and quotes mm-hmm. from Jim Zub, mm-hmm. Andy Belliger, just tons of others. Alex Proyas, the director of the original Crow. Mm-hmm. People are just loving the book. And so it feels great. And we just can't wait to share it with everybody.
Is this an ongoing series?
I would think of it. We'll probably try to put out a volume a year, just again, because we all got other projects going on. Mm-hmm. And again, we can't, you know, because of our indie budget, you know, we can't afford to just say, "Hey, Ben, sit down for 3 to 6 months and do this," and we can just crank it out. We kind of have to piecemeal it out. It's just the reality of indie comics, baby. But, you know, it it actually paid off, because I think you'll notice Ben's art as it just really progresses throughout the course of the book. Mm. I mean, you literally see him becoming a master in real time. Mm. And it was exciting to watch.
Have you thought about crowdfunding to pay for stuff?
Crowdfunding is, it's I have thought about it. I've dabbled it in the past, but I'll be honest with you. I'm not a household name, Wayne, so I just don't – I haven't had a lot of success in there. But, you know, it works great. If you're Keanu Reeves and you're co-writing, creating Berserker, I mean, and not taking away from any of those guys, Matt Kent's one of my favorite creators, and Keanu Reeves made some of my favorite movies, and he seems like a super nice guy. But I'm just saying, you know, that's where crowdfunding really comes into play when you're a household name already. Mm-hmm. That's why you see a lot of big names comics writers and artists use crowdfunding now, because they've probably made their names at the big two and can attract the fandom. And you know, a lot of people do have success, mm-hmm. but it's just a major challenge, and it's hard enough just to get the book out and get it made together. So I wouldn't rule it out, but this is a model we found that's working. Okay. And so we're pretty pleased with it. So.
Great. Again, it's called Death Slinger. And whose company you get it through again?
It's Cosmic Lion Productions. If you go to cosmiclionproductions.com, or you could just even Google Death Slinger. One word, Death Slinger, and CosmicLionProductions.com. Google's going to take you straight to the website where you can order it.
Okay. And then, Shane, if people want to follow you online, how do they do that?
On Instagram, you can follow me on at Shane, S-H-A-N-E, Berryhill, B-E-R-R-Y-H-I-L-L-1. And I'm also on Facebook as Shane Berryhill, Writer.
Okay. Well, look, it's great fun. I got to read this one, and I really enjoyed it, so I'm anxious to see more in the future. Are there other projects you're working on we should be aware of?
Well, again, we've talked about most of them, but yes, always irons in the fire. I'm actually been emailing with a former DC artist, not necessarily former, but a freelance artist for them, about doing a project together, but nothing I can just talk about just yet, Wayne.
Okay.
Death Slinger's our baby for right now.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, I highly recommend it. And Shane, I wish you much success, and I hope we get to read a lot of your stuff in the coming months ahead. So keep up the wonderful stuff.
You too, Wayne. Thank you again for all you do for the medium of comics. Thanks to your listeners. We appreciate you. We need you. We love you. And just keep reading comics, people.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.